Hello and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives, coming at you from ADA Sci Sessions in New Orleans. My name is Diana Isaacs. I am joined with my co-host, Natalie Bellini, and we have another very special guest. We have Dr. Ketan Dattaria from the UK, and we are so grateful you're joining us. And if you don't mind introducing yourself for our listeners and viewers and telling us a little bit about yourself.
So I am a consultant. I'm a diabetes doctor from Norwich in the UK. I am also a professor of medicine at the University of East Anglia in Norwich. I've been in my current position for 22 years now. I have lots of positions in the UK. I chair the Association of British Clinical Diabetologists, and that's we represent the voice of the diabetes doctor. So unlike the ADA, which is a multi-professional organization and also advocates for people with diabetes, in the UK, that's an organization called Diabetes UK, which does the same thing, but a bit, maybe a bit like ACE, which is predominantly for diabetes doctors and endocrinologists. That's the organization I chair. And I chair a few other things as well. I chair the equivalent of the board exam for endocrinology in the UK. In endocrinology and a few other things, but those are some of my jobs anyway. Yeah,
sounds like you're not busy at all.
No, right, not exactly. At all. No, not at all. I used to also be the chair of the Joint British Diabetes Societies for Inpatient Care, where we've written like 20 guidelines on the management of inpatients with diabetes.
Ooh, wow. Okay, so many things there.
Yeah, lots of things.
Yeah, well, I'm curious, what are the big issues facing clinical diabetologists in the UK?
There are several, I think. I mean, it can be divided into the workforce. It can be divided into what we're doing, what we're asked to do. It can be divided into the limitations that we have and the good things that we do as well. I think that in terms of the workforce, what are we asked to do? Certainly our trainees, our resident doctors, they are challenged because diabetes historically has been seen as something that's easy. And therefore, our resident doctors do a lot of internal medicine. They have to do a lot of internal medicine, and the training is affected when half their training is made up by internal medicine and only a year of endocrinology and a year of diabetes, for example. And at the end of that, you're supposed to be a consultant. And that's, you're not a specialist. Whereas other people who, you know, pass tubes, for example, they end gastroenterologists or chest physicians or cardiologists or whatever, they get dedicated time and protected time away from doing the front door stuff so they can train because they're thought to be special.
Right.
And it's a real dilemma. And so we're trying to extract our trainees from, you know, they're trying to get them seen as specialists as well. In terms of implementation, we have a lot of stuff, you know, a lot of the guidelines that we've written. How do we get those to the people that do the front door? Everything that we've written is all for the non-specialists, for example. How do you manage DKA? How do you manage people on steroids? How do you manage women in labor? And how do you people are not diabetes experts. They don't have time to read a textbook. So we published, you know, short sharp guidelines, which will hopefully be used. How do you get those? How do you get them to be used? You know, you can take a horse to water.
Right.
You can't
right.
get them drinking. But yeah, you give them the documents. How do we implement that? And then it's just about, you know, the stuff that's being presented here, for example, all the fantastic new stuff that's coming out, the new molecules. You know, we're pharmacologists and technologists. So we have, you know, what an exciting time to be in diabetes. It's a really yes. exciting time with all of the new things, but they come at a cost.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And,
right.
you know, health economics is such that what do you give a really expensive technology to a small number of people or drug, or do you give it a cheaper thing to a lot of people, which is not as good? And those are decisions that we try and influence policymakers. We try and influence government. We try and influence the people that make the decisions to help as many people as possible, but also embracing the fact that, you know, the technology works, these drugs work, and a little bit of money spent now saves a lot of money later on. And it's trying to convince people that that's the case. But, you know, it's a fist fight because, you know, cardiologists or the gastroenterologist or the ENT surgeons,
they're all going to fight the same fight.
It's a small amount of money. It's a small pot of money. And they're going to fight their own corner.
Right.
And we have to say, look, actually, diabetes affects 10% of the population. And that's a large number of people. And if we spend a little bit of money now, we will save hundreds of millions, billions going on. But these are conversations that have been had for a long time. So, Yeah, it keeps me off the streets.
I mean, the health system, yeah, it's so much different.
It's very different.
It's very different. You have a bottom line that you don't. I mean, you have a certain amount of money.
It's a certain.
We in the U.S. just keep spending whether we have it or not, right? I mean, there is something to be said for the idea that there's no limit.
The issue is that the way that the health service was set up in 1948 was that everything is free from the free at the point of care.
Right.
So we all pay it. Anybody who earns any money pays tax. You all pay a proportion of tax to the health service and for social care. That goes to the government. And because it's now been, you know, coming up to 80 years, we all agree with it. With nobody, there's no dissent because everybody's going to need it. Everybody doesn't. And we look at, it's only when you leave the UK that you see the disparity of care that occurs in places where people have to pay for their own care. And, you know, the haves and have nots, that you realize actually the UK has something. And I appreciate that not everybody agrees with that. And I have good friends in the US who say, it's my money. Why should I pay for anybody else? And that's a frame of mind, which I don't agree with, but that's fine. That's not a problem. Everybody is different. But what it means is that there's a fixed pot of money. And because everything is free, not everybody can get everything they want at the time they want it. So if you have an elective operation, you know, knee operation, you may have to wait 18 months. But you'll get it, and it will be for free, and you'll get the care that you need, but you just have to wait for it.
And how does that fall into diabetes and diabetes technology? I mean, I know there's been a huge shift in the past of years. You and some of your colleagues have really pushed for access to CGM, for access to AID.
Yes.
Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
So there's been some really, there's been a couple of personalities in the UK really driven it forward. And so that CGM use for people with type 1 diabetes is almost universal.
Right.
And so for children, it's definitely universal. And for adults, if they want it, they can get it. Usually if they don't want it, then it's their choice. They can just stay with finger pricking. And for AID, it's similar for children. It's no problem. And closed loop, it's absolutely no problem whatsoever. For adults, because of this issue about money, there is a pot of money that has been ring-fenced from the government. So this is going to be used for that. But it's over a period of years. Right. And so every year, there'll be a more and more and more. You can't put everybody on it straight away because, you know, the onboarding takes time. It takes effort. You know, the staff have to be there, the clinic facilities, and the patients have to come through. So what we're doing is as people come through, they can be put through it. You know, they just come up for their regular reviews. You run the queue now, you can go for it. So over a period of 5 or 6, 7 years, it will be offered to everybody. And so everybody should get it. And then, of course, it comes on to renewing it and giving it the next generation of devices and so on. So there is a plan and it works. And, you know, the data from the UK is fantastic.
Phenomenal.
You know, the HbA1c, the average HbA1c of children has gone down. You know, the HbA1c of women going through pregnancy on devices is amazing.
Right.
You know, and these are because of the work that's been done by my colleagues in the UK who are just the world's experts on these devices and the technology and the care of these, the kids and the pregnant women in particular. And you hope that these are the people who have got the most to gain. You know, the children straight away are going to never have to, you know, prick their fingers. They're never going to have to think about it. They just live with the devices, and hopefully that will translate into fewer complications and, you know, living longer, healthy lives. And similarly with women, that gives the children the best chance of a greatest life they could ever lead. Fingers crossed.
That's very exciting.
Yeah, and ultimately, when you do have to pick, you have to start with the most. I mean, children have the most. Their numbers. The clinical word I use is wonky.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
They're just up and down. You know, they're absolutely like, I'm going to go play soccer. I'm going to go do this. I'm going to eat this. I'm going to run here. I'm going to watch TV for the next 2 hours. And where adults, their lives are much more predictable and their numbers are more predictable because we're not growing.
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah.
So,
But also those people who have got chaotic lives, that actually you can offer them something which MDI doesn't offer them.
Right.
you know, right. And you can say, well, try it and have it. And it's not a one-way street. If you don't like it, come back, give it back to us, and you can go back to what you... But most people go, no, thank you very much. Right. I'll keep this, thank you.
Exactly.
Because they know they can see the benefit fairly quickly, and and hopefully most of them...
Right.
Yeah, so great.
Starting with children and pregnant women is the way you have to start. Yeah. I mean, that makes the most sense,
I'm
right?
I'm curious about type 2 diabetes.
Yeah.
So are people with type 2 able to get CGM if they're on insulin?
There are certain criteria, because obviously the numbers are huge. And yes, you can get it if you're on dialysis, if frequent hypos, you're on MDI, you can get it. But those numbers are much fewer. And having said that, the more and more information is coming out about the reduction in admissions, reduction in DKAs, reduction now there's the beginnings of the data to show that CGM use is microvascular disease complication.
Yes.
Just literally, it's just coming out in the last year or so. So I think there will be soon enough a cost effectiveness argument to say, yes, these devices are expensive, but actually, here's the data.
We're going to be able to pull from that cardiology.
Exactly.
We're going to pull from retinopathy.
Hopefully.
We're going to pull from kidney disease and say, give it to us up front, and we're going to reduce that risk.
And will it be going out to everybody? Will it be, when you first are diagnosed having type 2 and you get it and you see the dietary effects and you see, and that just gives you that, it gives you the insight.
Yes.
I remember, I'm very lucky, I don't have diabetes yet, but I wore a device and, I was thinking, and I had a full fat Coke, and I was like, now that's why we use it to treat hypos. Because, you see it.
You watched it go up.
You watched
right?
it.
Absolutely.
You watched it go, and I was like, even though you tell people you see it, it's actually seeing it on the device, you go, oh, yeah.
Right.
It really does.
And how many have you had since then?
No, not many.
See that?
No.
Someone said
zero.
This.
Yeah,
another
zero.
Clinician recently said to me that they eat some sort of, I don't know what it is, peanut butter and jelly thing. And she said, oh, no, I started. And I said, oh, are you still, and she said, absolutely
it's
not.
Immediately,
do you know what that does to my glucose?
It changes your behavior straight away.
It changes your behavior
it's
straight
amazing.
Away. And that, I think what, yeah, exactly.
I was just going to ask if people are paying for, if non-insulin treated are just paying out of pocket.
Yeah. Because unlike the US, where it is a prescribable device, you can only get, say, a Libre on prescription, you can buy it over the counter in the UK. You can buy it. They're not cheap. They're about, $35 a pop. But you can buy them. And you can just go into a pharmacy and buy them.
And some people do that.
Yeah, you can buy on Amazon, you can do whatever. There's no reason why you can't. Yeah, some people do it because they want to know what's going on. In fact, there's a whole study which is giving people the devices to see if it changes their behavior and so on. The only trouble with that is that it exposed the worried well.
Yes.
Oh, my blood glucose is, what is it? My blood glucose is 85. What does that mean? Well, it's normal. But, what do these spikes mean? Actually, it's normal. Don't worry about it. Oh, but every now and again, my blood glucose goes to 130. Well, so what?
Right.
It doesn't.
Also normal, right?
Yes,
exactly.
It's normal, but people, they're worried well.
Yes.
And therefore, you have to deal with that, or primary care potentially has to deal with that. And that's a bit frustrating sometimes.
Yeah, we see that too in our clinical practices where, I think that's going to be anywhere where you have access to something with not full understanding of what you're using.
Yeah, exactly right.
And you decide that you're hypo. We see a lot of, when people have false lows without medicine that causes lows. And I didn't like it and I didn't, and it's like, it could not have been 20.
Yeah.
Your glucose couldn't have been
you
40,
been,
right?
Yeah.
You fell asleep on it. It happens every night and the same time, and I think you're rolling over on your shoulder, right? But that discussion is taking time up when you have a line of, when's your next available appointment and how do you get people in when you're having some worried well person come?
Exactly.
It's a tough thing, right? Yeah, it is.
I'm curious on the access of GLP-1 drugs in the UK.
So there are two different groups. Mm-hmm. So those people with diabetes, no problem at all.
Okay.
So
anyone with type 2?
Type 2 diabetes with a certain BMI. Although, so there's an organization in the UK, which is called NICE, the National Institute for Clinical and Healthcare Excellence, which tells us what we can or should not use. They do a huge cost and economic analysis that underpins their recommendation. So for people with type 2 diabetes, they published their update in February of this year. And it says that, if you've got a BMI above 35, for example, you've got comorbidities, or you've got pre-existing atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, you'll get it.
Yes.
Or regardless of BMI. And if you're diagnosed under the age of 40, you'll get it you should get it. So metformin, SGLT2, GLP-1, regardless of BMI. So so that people with type 2 diabetes, if you fall into those categories, there's no problem at all because it's mandated by NICE. Now, if you're living with obesity, that's a different issue because so many people are eligible for the drug and the drugs are not cheap. There has to be some kind of, again, we're back to health economics. And so what's happened is that the UK Department of Health, and I was part of these conversations, was that if you say that 3 million people are eligible for the drug, but the infrastructure in primary care isn't there to be able to prescribe it, you know, and issue refills and keep managing them and reviewing these people. So they said, right, you've got to have four out of five different criteria. So the high BMI, pre-diabetes or diabetes, obstructive sleep apnea, dyslipidemia, hypertension, and I think one other. If you have, you fulfill those, but that immediately limits it down to about 30 or 40,000 for the first year. Mm-hmm. And that's manageable for both the money and primary care. And then in a couple of years, when all of those people are on them, then they'll decrease the BMI threshold to say 35.
Okay.
And then more people will get it. And then maybe three out of four criteria and more people get it. So over, and they've said, the government has said that over about 12 years, everybody who's eligible for it should get it. Now, that's brilliant because they've actually realized that since COVID, a large proportion of the population is off sick, you know, economically inactive, not contributing to tax coffers.
Right.
And therefore, it's economically worth the government paying for the drug because so much of the people who are not economically active, who should be or could be, it's because of obesity-driven disease.
Wow.
Okay. You know, there's depression, diabetes, not necessarily diabetes, but hypertension, osteoarthritis, back pain, whatever it could be. Yeah. And if all of those improve, then they can get
back
to work.
You're going to increase the workforce.
And the cost, the tax returns offset the cost of the drug.
Right.
Also, are some going to be going generic?
They are. So you've already got generic liraglutide.
Yeah. Okay.
But not many people prescribe that. I don't know. I mean, for whatever reason, it is not a huge amount cheaper. But in 12 years, of course, you'll expect the ones that are currently available to be.
And,
you know, at this meeting, we've heard about the amazing new molecules coming out. But they're very good. But the drugs we've got right now, which are quite expensive, are also very good.
Yes.
Yeah. And by the time we need them, they'll hopefully become generic. So, but you know, in semaglutide's generic in India and in Canada. So, and it's dirt cheap. It's dirt cheap. So let's see. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, we found out about $12 a month for semaglutide.
Yeah, it is. In India, it's 600 rupees a month, which is about $10.
Yeah.
$10 a month. I mean, that compared to whatever it is here, it's just ridiculous.
Right. Do people have to pay any component of it when they're eligible?
So about 60 or 70% of the population doesn't pay a penny.
Right.
Okay. Because if you're over the age of 65, if you're on any benefits, if you're a child on, you know, in full-time education, and there are a whole host of exclusions that mean that you get your drugs for free and only a small proportion of people pay for the drugs.
Okay, that's great.
It's a copay. In the US, it's a minimum copay, and that's it's literally just under £10, which is, you know, $14 or $15, whatever.
Yeah, that's great because we know in the US people could have coverage, but then have a high deductible and
exactly.
There's all kinds of crazy.
So you know, it's so complicated.
It's very complicated.
Yes,
I get that.
Yeah, I want to talk just a little bit about inpatient diabetes technology.
Yeah, of course,
yes.
You've contributed.
Talk to us about that. Great. Yeah, so what are we doing?
Well, I'm curious. We can start with CGM in the UK. How is that being used on the inpatient side?
We had this discussion. So we don't have a routine CGM for inpatients. You know, they don't go in and you apply it. Yeah. Not yet, because it's not licensed. It's not, you know, we know that it's not approved for that. Now, what happens is, of course, as more and more people are using them in outpatients, they are being admitted on them.
Right.
And so we have a document which we've written. We wrote a couple of years ago. If anybody's interested, just Google JBDS, Joint British Diabetes Society for Inpatient Care. So JBDS devices, and it comes up. It'll be the first hit that you get. And we wrote a document for the non-specialist.
Right.
And it just gives flowcharts. You know, does this thing measure glucose?
Right.
Yes or no. And if it doesn't, does it deliver insulin? Yes or no?
I love it.
You know, it's as simple as that. And then he's got algorithms about what does it, and then you work out whether this is, you know, because you've got, let's say, the Omnipod, you've got tubeless devices. You've got to know what it is. for the non-specialist at 3 in the morning,
right,
when the person comes in with, you know, dreadful tummy pain, you've got to know what this is.
Right.
So you don't just necessarily take it off and throw it in the bin without knowing, and that, because that's ridiculous.
Right.
You know, when in doubt, ask the patient, because if they're using a device, they will have been given an enormous amount of education and they'll be able to tell you what it is.
Right.
So we have guidelines that you can continue using either the CGM or the insulin delivery device or the AID, whatever, if you are well enough to do so.
Right. That's exactly
key.
What ours
that is.
You
key.
Need, yeah. Someone needs to be able to do it, yeah. Right? You have to be able to push, because you can't train a nurse or whoever is coming to the bedside to bring a lunch.
Yeah, you can.
How to bolus on 3 or 4 or 5 different things, or how to problem solve if it's beeping, or
correct,
when to turn it off, or
exactly,
they need to be able to operate their
so
own.
So our guidelines say, if the individual is not well enough, if they are, for whatever reason, they want to take a holiday from their diabetes, whatever,
yeah,
you take the device off them, you label it, you store it carefully, and you write in the notes or in the EHR where you've put it.
Yes, because there's lots of stories of losing.
Exactly.
Right?
So, you know,
exactly,
we write it very carefully. Make sure you don't do it. So there are situations, you know, perioperative care, for example, it depends on whether the individual is going to be, how many meals they miss.
Right.
If they miss more than one meal, put them onto a variable rate.
Okay.
Intravenous insulin infusion. Because, you know, that's going to be safer for them if they're going to be unconscious for a while, not be able to look after themselves for a time because they've had an operation, anesthetic, whatever. We give them instructions, you know, how far away it's supposed to be from the operative site. If you're diathermy, if you're going to have an imaging, MRI, whatever.
Right.
There are criteria, which we've gone through in great detail. We wrote it 2 years ago. We realized it's already out of date. Many people are using CGM. More and more people are using CGM.
Right.
And, you know, we've heard here to, you know, over the last few days that about inpatient use of CGM and how it's going to transform care. And
right,
how putting, you know, my dream is that somebody goes into hospital, they go onto an AID closed loop system, and it just, one less
harm,
thing
right,
to worry
right,
about. One, all we need to do is just make sure that controlling glucose ends up improving care or
right,
improving or reducing complications.
Right.
Right now, we're just assuming that is the case.
Right.
We don't have much data, but by improving dysglycemia and reducing dysglycemia, actually that translates to better outcomes.
Right.
Once
right,
we show that, that, my hope is just, yeah,
right,
straight away.
I want to back up a second to something you said, that if they're on a device, they've received a tremendous amount of education.
Yeah.
I want to understand that a little bit better. What is the process for getting educated on devices?
So, yeah, talk to us about Daphne, right?
Yeah,
Daphne.
Well, Daphne is one thing. Yep. So Daphne stands for Dose Adjustment for Normal Eating. So that was set up initially in the late 80s by a guy called Michael Berger in Dusseldorf. And in Germany, what they used to do is that they would admit their newly diagnosed people with type 1 diabetes. And, you know, the very German process was brilliant.
Girl.
You know, they just told, this is what it is. You were in for a week. You were taught what to do. And three of my colleagues in the UK, Stephanie Amill, Simon Heller, and one other who I've forgotten who it was now, but they went to Germany and learned what to do. And because in the UK, we could never admit people for that. They developed it as an outpatient 1 week education course for people with diabetes. So most people with type 1 diabetes, if they're going to be offered some technology, will be offered Daphne first, because it is a carbohydrate counting, you know, how to look at, I mean, it's a 1 week, Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, how to look after your diabetes.
Do people get excused from work?
We write them a letter. So
yeah,
we've run Daphne where I am since 2004, 2005. And most employers have no problem with it. And the reason is because the data suggests they take less time off sick.
Yep.
They take less time for hospital appointments, and therefore it pays for itself quite quickly.
Gosh, isn't that amazing? Wouldn't you love that? Right, yep.
Yeah, we just don't have anything like that.
No, there are some systems that do this intensive diabetes education, right? There, it's 3 or 4 or 5 days of come and do that.
It's awesome. It's awesome.
But it's hard to get someone to, I mean, in the United States, we don't get that many weeks off anyway. So if you are going to take 5 days off, you might only get 5 more days for the rest of the year.
But now the other thing is, what
happens? There's no medical on top of it, right?
I get it. So there's different ways of doing Daphne. You could do it one day a week over, you know, different days of the week, or there's
all kinds of ways.
There's lots of ways. And so the Daphne team have been developing different ways over the market. 15 years of how to, because of this reason,
right,
to try and make it
right,
less.
You could go every Monday for 5 Mondays,
exactly,
as opposed to
exactly,
every day of the week, in case
And
virtual, do they do them virtual?
They did do them virtually during COVID, but it's very much a hands-on. Yep. It's experiential adult learning.
Right.
You learn from others. You know, right. What, you know, it used to be, you know, the acetates used to go up on the wall, you know, what are your blood glucose readings? And you'd show them and everybody would learn from another individual's reading. So that's the way it would be done. But in answer to your question is about the education is that unlike the US, the vast majority of people with type 1 are looked after in secondary care. And so, you know, you've got the endocrinologist, you've got the diabetes nurses or the educators, you've got the dietitian, you've got whoever needs to be seen. And when they are onboarded, it will be as a multidisciplinary team and they'll get all the education. The idea that I've done Daphne or an equivalent before they do that so they'll understand the process. Here, you know, 70% of people are looked after in primary care. And, you know, if you're a primary care doctor, you may only have three or four people with type 1 diabetes on your books.
Yeah.
And how do you get the specialist knowledge to look after them? You can prescribe the device, you can give the device, but who's going to train them how to use it?
Right.
And, you know, these devices, I'm going to use an analogy. It, you know, many years ago, I remember when I got a mobile phone, you got a 500-page book.
Yes, you did. Right.
How to use it. Yeah. Okay. Now you take it out of the box and it's intuitive.
Right.
Okay, now with the what the primary care doctors here are assuming that it's like a mobile phone. You just, it's intuitive, use it. But of course it isn't.
Right.
You need to know how to use these devices. They are very, very complicated pieces of kit and they can go wrong and you need to know what to do when it beeps at you or when it doesn't. It's not like a phone where you can just turn it on and off. You can't do that. This is your life.
It's life, right.
It's exactly. It's your life.
It's insulin, right? I mean, this is not, isn't.
So you do, you know, you need somebody telling you about the book.
Right.
You can't, you don't have the book itself, but you know, you need to have that education.
And also as the clinician, as the patient and as the clinician, when to make changes for what?
Correct.
Not just how to get it started.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And picking the proper settings today. If I'm starting Diana on a pump today, based on weight, exercise, whatever her previous insulin dose is, I can get her started. But what happens when she says, I am going on steroids. I wouldn't like to have a baby. I hurt my ankle and I'm going to be out 6 weeks and I'm going to do no exercise. All of those would cause pump. We would need to change those pump settings.
Exactly.
There are very few primary care in the US that know how to do it well. Exactly. Right. Or that feel good about it even. Right. That is the.
And that's the big difference because the vast majority of that's why we believe that type one is a secondary care condition. It should not be looked after in primary care.
Right.
Because we can offer the devices. We can offer the education. We can offer everything. And people can pick up the phone and they will talk to somebody who knows.
Right. There's a problem. They call the nurse and the nurse will call them back. And
Exactly.
I mean, I think in the U.S. we wish people would come to endocrinology care. You know, I think that there's been some of its access. I mean, some of it is you're driving so far to get there and they can't afford the gas right now. And they there's a lot of cans, right? Some of it is negative interactions in the office. And the patient says, I'm never doing that again.
Exactly.
Right? We didn't do great care before.
And not every hospital's got an endocrinologist.
So, right, you know, exactly.
But
you're right. There is not great training. And we are now trying to develop diabetologists. And saying, I think there's a movement towards people working towards being able to manage this because they recognize that there's a problem.
Yeah.
But we're still far from having the people with type 1, the majority of them seeing endo.
Yeah.
Right.
But that's what the advocacy of ADA and Asia or whatever, that's what you need to advocate for. That's what you want to advocate for the people with diabetes. Ultimately, they're the people we're here for.
That's exactly it.
And it's it's painful to watch people not get the care that they really could benefit from.
Right.
And it's really, really hard to see sometimes. So back to haves and have nots.
Right. Here we are. Right.
Wow. Well, thank you. This has been an incredible discussion. Very thought-provoking. We thank you so much. And we thank you all for tuning in. And that wraps up this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.